This is the Florida Spectacular Podcast with your hosts, Kathy Silustri and Rick Kilby. Keep up with Kathy at greatfloridaroadtrip.com and on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Silustri. Find Rick on Twitter at OldFLA and visit his website, rickkilby.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Hey everyone, welcome back to this week's episode of Florida Spectacular. This week we have a return guest. He hasn't been on since, well, a really long time ago. Rick was just a glimmer in my eye, or not even. So first things first, before we introduce the guest, this mystery guest, how are you, Rick?
I'm spectacular. I'm Florida spectacular.
You are Florida spectacular. We did miss you at the Floridania Festival, though.
Yeah, I'm not sure where we got our wires crossed. I didn't think I was invited this year, but it sounds like I missed something.
Apparently, you're invited every year.
Who knew?
I really want us to do a live podcast from there next year because those are our people.
Those are our people, and, you know, it's tough to beat Gulfport.
I mean, I like it. Speaking of Gulfport, well, not really Gulfport, but Pinellas County, of which Gulfport is a part, we have with us today the former historian for one of Henry Plant's hotels that had been reduced to a shred of its former self. And I don't know if I could give you a better introduction than that. Like to welcome back to the podcast, Joey Vars. Good morning, Joey.
Woohoo, woohoo.
Good morning, everyone. Good to see y'all again.
So, Joey, when last we spoke, you were the historian at the Biltmore, although you didn't, what did we have to call it? The Bellevue Biltmore? You wouldn't let me call it that?
Nowadays, they refer to it as the Bellevue Inn.
The Bellevue Inn. So it's supposed to be the Biltmore. In my heart, it is always the Biltmore.
In my heart, it's always the Biltmore. Although, personally, I actually like calling it the Bellevue now. And I think that's kind of a good way to bridge the gap between the traditional Bellevue Biltmore Hotel and kind of the downsized, reimagined Bellevue Inn. So I like calling it just the Bellevue now.
Are you in... Yeah, go on, Rick.
I feel like we need some context to bring people up to speed because they may, I mean, to me, it's on my radar and it has been since I first learned about the Bellevue Biltmore, but we have to assume the listeners don't know anything about it. So, Joey, can you give us like a quick overview?
Yeah. So, the Bellevue Biltmore was originally opened in 1897 by Henry Plant. It was his third and final custom hotel that was built in Florida. And it was the only one of his hotels that successfully had operated into the 21st century as an actual operating hotel. And by time it closed due to dilapidation in 2009, it was one of only three wooden Gilded Age hotels left in the entire United States. There was about a 9-year period that it was closed where we had the Great Recession, a lot of just structural issues, and then a St. Petersburg developer purchased the property, developed about 90% of the property into condominiums, and they preserved about 10% of the hotel, which translates to the lobby and the 35 rooms above the lobby. And that is what has been moved about 350 feet east from its original location and restored and reopened as a small little boutique type inn. And they call it an inn to the Bellevue Biltmore had always been renowned for.
So a quick question, how many times, you know, so Plant built the original structure, how many times was it expanded that they add on to that original building?
There was a total of 4 expansions beyond the original structure. So you saw the first expansion by Morton Plant in 1905.
Who was Morton Plant?
Yes, Morton Plant was Henry Plant's son. He actually took over the hotel right after Henry died, which was very shortly after the hotel opened. It was his last hotel. So Morton Plant does the first expansion in 1905 when he's trying to turn it into a big golf resort. There was another expansion in 1910 and 1914. Morton Plant dies of Spanish influenza, and then it's the hotel's purchased by the Biltmore Corporation, which is where the famous surname comes from. And then the Biltmore Company adds the fourth and final wing, which was the south wing of the building, in 1924. And once the building had expanded that much, it became the second largest occupied wooden building in North America. Now, what was interesting about that is once 1924 rolled around and it was the final expansion, one of Henry Flagler's hotels, the Royal Poinciana down in Palm Beach, that actually was significantly larger. And that was the largest wooden building in the world. But that structure was torn down in 1938, which then passed the crown to the Bellevue Biltmore. And the only structure in the country larger out of wood is the Del Coronado Hotel, which is another Gilded Age hotel in San Diego. And that is the largest wooden building, period, on the continent.
You know, it's a shame you don't have any passion for your subject.
You can't tell, right?
Right. So as long as you mentioned Morton Plant, so I wanted to talk to you a little bit. I want to tell you a story that I was told a long time ago, and I want you to tell me which parts of it are true, because I am not the only person who heard this story. It's going to be good. It's going to be
good. He's cringing.
So this is good. We can be like history mythbusters or not. A long time ago, before I was as successful as a writer as I am now, I had a part-time job. I always had part-time jobs when I started out as a writer. They were always fascinating things. I worked as a kayak tour guide. I worked as ground crew for the airplanes that tow banners up and down the beach. I worked as crew on a speedboat. Speedboat dolphin watching. There is a boat up at the Clearwater Marina that is this big yellow boat, and it throws a big wake and the dolphins chase it, and people love that because, oh, look, the dolphins are having fun with us. Maybe. But there's a lot of, if you take this big speedboat, you can't just go out of the gate super fast. So you have to go super slow, no wake zones. And while you're going super slow, people aren't seeing dolphins. So you have to amuse them with something. And the way every charter boat that has a mate who any charter boat that works for tips, we tell stories. And these stories become legend. And so coming out of the Clearwater Marina, obviously, you come out of Clearwater Marina, you can see Morton Plant Hospital. And the story I was told and the story that I continued to tell until I left was about how Morton Plant Hospital came to be. You want to hear it?
Yeah, he's not sure.
Sure, why not?
All right. So, let me see if I can do it like as my tour guide spiel. Around the turn of the last century, we had a railroad magnate, Henry Plant, who brought his railroad down through Florida along the West Coast. And he had a special private rail line that went off the main railroad to his hotel. And it was the hotel, of course, was the Bellevue Biltmore. You can no longer see it because, and Joey, forgive me, this was when it was closed. It's been left to demolition by neglect. But if you ever wondered why, if you live in Clearwater, we have a hospital right on the water with some of the best views. Well, the reason for that is Morton Plant was Henry Plant's son, and he was very badly injured in a car accident when they were staying at the Biltmore. And of course, there were no hospitals here because it was the turn of the century and it was a very wild area, unpopulated, except for Henry Plant. But fortunately for the Plant family, they had a lot of money. And so what they did when Morton Plant was so gravely injured is they had three rail cars rushed in, filled with medical supplies, operating equipment, and doctors and nurses. And those three rail cars are where they saved Morton Plant's life. They became the foundation for Morton Plant Hospital. And that is why we have a hospital on such a nice piece of property. Would not be for the bad luck of Morton Plant being in a car accident. And then we go on to tell the people that the three cars were in the same site as the hospital, and that's why the hospital is named Morton Plant. Okay, go.
Oh boy, that's always a fun one. That's actually one of the big local folklores of the Clearwater region. And it's actually been kind of fun to trace the evolution of that idea over the decades. So that story itself actually originated in the early 1980s history of Morden Plant Hospital. When they were
1980s?
Trying to compile the first set. I think this was from 1982 is when they were compiling the actual, 1981.
He actually showed us a cover of the book. He had it on hand, fortunately for us, or for those who can't see through the podcast.
Which is everybody.
It's called Giant Steps.
Oh, there's a whole mound of books piled up behind me. It's called Giant Steps, the history of Morden Plant Hospital. And so that's where that legend originated from. But it's actually an amalgamation of a few different historical events that had been kind of passed down as hearsay before kind of being improperly written down like this. So the Plant system, back when Henry Plant was still alive and still in charge of his massive railroad network, this is back in the 1880s, 1890s, the Plant system of railroads was the first railroad in the United States to offer a health plan for their employees. And about a dollar from their paycheck would be taken out and it would go towards these company-wide hospitals. And so there are four of these built in the American South. And if you weren't able to make it to one of these hospitals, or if there is a derailment or some type of incident along the line, not by a hospital, the Plant system also had railroad hospital cars. And that is something that the Plant system had always been kind of well known for at the time. So that's part of that story. That's one of the details. The other detail comes from 1916. And this is where it gets interesting. So Morden Plant Hospital opened on February 1st, 1916. And about not even two weeks after it opened, Morden Plant's son, Henry Plant Jr., was in a car accident not far from the Bellevue property. Now, it's actually, it was the corner of Myrtle Avenue and Howard Street in Clearwater. There is nothing here that denotes. Yeah, there's nothing here that denotes this is where this accident was. I kind of just had it picked out from a few other details, but that ended up being, and it makes sense because that was actually the original road alignment to drive to Clearwater at the time before they built the southern part of Fort Harrison. So that would have been the main road going in. And so what happened was Henry Plant, we don't know if he was driving or Henry Plant Jr. We don't know if he was a passenger or the driver. But somehow the train and the car touched, and vehicles don't touch each other, supposedly. So
not well, and so
the entire party who is in this car accident was taken directly to Morden Plant Hospital, including Henry Plant Jr. And that is the story of the car accident. Now, all of this had kind of been combined into a single story very early on. And then it was just kind of spoken verbally throughout the decades until it was written down in the 1980s. And then what we saw once all of these facts had merged together was that the legend started that Henry Plant Jr., Morden Plant's son, was in a car accident. There was not a local hospital nearby. So Morden Plant brings these old hospital railroad cars to the Bellevue, and this provided the inspiration to found the hospital. It's a neat story, but when you actually look at the different facts that kind of originated it, it's kind of funny to see that Henry Plant Jr. was taken to Morden Plant Hospital, which then inspired the building of the hospital, in air quotes.
It seems like a little bit of a loop. Maybe there was some time travel.
There was a little bit in there. I mean, when you have enough money to build Gilded Age stuff, there's probably a time machine in there somewhere, like Doc Brown and his train.
H.G. Wells was staying at the Bellevue Biltmore at the time, and he had his time machine with him.
He had it there. You know, it's odd that you mention time machines, because I love to talk about, when we talk about the Biltmore, a Tampa Bay author, Charlotte Douglas. That's her real name. But she's also written under the name Marina Malcolm. And she wrote a wonderful book. She wrote a series of historical books. They were intrigue about the Plant Hotel, the Tampa Bay Hotel. But also, this is what's fascinating to me, is that she also wrote under the name Charlotte Douglas. She wrote Harlequins. And her one book, I can't remember the name of it. I'm going to get up and go to my bookcase and get it. Her one book was set at the Biltmore. And it's a Harlequin. It's a love story, but it's not your typical Harlequin. My mom found it. She's like, Kathy, you've got to read this. And she, woman, goes to sleep in the present day Biltmore. And this was written before the Biltmore was closed. So present day probably being the 80s or 90s. She goes to sleep in the present day Biltmore and she wakes up and it's back in the heyday of the Biltmore. And she falls in love with somebody there. And here's the description. It's called It's About Time. When Tori Caswell attended her sister's wedding in a magical old Victorian resort, her mind was filled with images of bouquets and garters. But when she awakened the next morning, she thought she was still dreaming because a gray-eyed hunk was sharing her pillow. Rand Trent had drunk some brandy the previous night, but not that much. He could never have forgotten sleeping in the arms of such a gorgeous woman. But was Tori Caswell sane? After all, the instant she got a second look at Rand, she started proclaiming it was 1995, when he knew good and well that it was the 1800s.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, it's a great book. I mean, it's clearly out of print. I mean, you'd have to really dig for it, but it is set entirely at the Biltmore. And it was 1995. So it's really, you know, she's a very, you know, skilled writer. She's very good at it. And I love all of her books. She also writes a cozy mystery series that's set in Dunedin. But I just love that there was a time travel book about the Biltmore written. So,
and I have to know, behind you, is there a shelf full of Harlequin romances?
You know what? I have wide and varied tastes. So just that is it's my closet. It's my shame. No, what you saw behind me was all the stuff that has to be, or it's my shelf.
We can't see you because you have a virtual background. So
I don't feel bad.
And my imagination it's just this wall of Harlequin romances and you have posters of Fabio and all that stuff.
No.
Oh, sorry. Okay, we're getting off track.
But we were talking about Marina Malco. It's About Time is the name of the book.
Oh, nice.
And then that was Charlotte Douglas. This, Joey, you'll appreciate this cover and I'll get a picture of it for the and that's Secrets in the Shadows. That's her
who knew?
Yeah.
You know, there's a big desire to one of the big genres of all the books that have been written about the Bellevue Biltmore. There are really only two novels that have ever been written, and they both have to do with falling in love at the hotel with either someone from the past or a spirit of someone from the past. So that building seemed to inspire a lot of paranormal romance mystery novels.
It's well, of course, I'm sure if you ask, it was haunted, right?
Do we want to even go there?
You know, I would love to go there, actually. It's one of my favorite little things to talk about. So, yeah, there was always stories that the Bellevue Biltmore was haunted. People love talking about that. To each their own. That's fun. But the neat thing, you know, as a historian, is trying to trace a lot of these stories and see where the ghost story itself originated from. And that was actually some of the big discoveries we've made recently. So in my 5+ years as historian of the Biltmore, all this is going towards my my graduate studies. And as I was looking into the ghost stories, we had pretty much found out that most of them were kind of just made up just to get people in the door in the 90s. But there had always been a story on the side that had always been treated a little bit differently. And there was just no details. It had said one of the massive cottages built by some of the wealthy visitors, that one of the cottages had been haunted by a family who died in a yacht accident before they could move in. But there was no additional information about it because all historical information from the hotel was lost during World War II. So I'm starting to delve into the history of this, and we end up finding out the actual origins of this ghost story. And one of the cottages on property was built by a gentleman from Indianapolis named Harry Yoakum. And Colonel Yoakum builds this cottage on the hotel grounds, and he was bringing his daughter and his daughter's school-age friends. They all had just graduated from school. And to celebrate their debut into society, which is what you would do if you were wealthy and prominent back in this time period, he was going to bring his daughter and his friends down to Bel Air, stay at the cottage for the season, debut into society, and then sail back to Indianapolis. And so no sooner does the party in a yacht enter the Gulf of Mexico out from the Mississippi River, does a storm hit. And the engine of the yacht explodes and it sinks. And unfortunately, they all died. And what I ended up finding out was Colonel Yoakum was one of the original financial backers of Bel Air when the hotel and kind of the town of Bel Air Heights was first being built. And so he was very well known within the culture of the hotel. Now, this was in 1899. So the hotel was just about to start its third year of operation. So he was very much part of the hotel culture, even though it was still a new hotel. And I posit that he had become so well known that when news broke that him and the family died, it just spread like wildfire throughout the hotel, that this was one of the earliest anecdotes of Bellevue history. And what we ended up seeing was during World War II, when the Army Air Forces moved in, all items in the hotel, all furnishings, furniture, paintings, artwork, historical documents, all of these items were taken out and put into the storage, and then they weren't actually brought back into the hotel after the war. So we've lost all pre-war documentation, including the story of what happened to Colonel Yoakum. Well, the original hotel manager from the 1890s visits the hotel in the late 1940s and is just relaying his stories of what it was like in, you know, 50 years earlier, and makes an offhand remark that, oh, take that cottage in the distance. That was built by Mr. Plant for Colonel Yoakum, who died in a yacht accident before he could move in. It was a great loss for the community. And that one singular phrase, because it was reintroduced to the hotel after it had lost all of its documentation, now bridged the gap between the original story of what happened and the new reborn historical amnesia version of the hotel. And so now that that was reintroduced in 1947, every 5 to 10 years in the hotel archives, like if you're looking in these documents, you see a reference to the haunting of Sunset Cottage. And the story is like a game of telephone, and it just changes throughout the years. And then by the 1990s, they actually included it in the hotel history tour. But then by the early 2000s, it wasn't mentioned at all. So when the hotel actually closed in 2009, the story of Colonel Yoakum that had been forgotten after the war was then turned into a ghost story in the late 20th century. It was now forgotten a second time. So finding the research for that is really neat because people do always expect to hear a lot of ghost stories. And I won't talk about a ghost story that was fabricated to bring people in the door. I'll talk about a ghost story that was fabricated because the historical information was just lost over time. And it was really kind of fun to come up with this, to really discover this whole forgotten story. So that's how far I'll go on the side of the ghosts.
He's just a myth buster, you know? He just like busting all those myths wide open. I have a big question. Here's a big question.
I'll put it this way.
Okay.
I'll put it this way as like a little sidebar. There's another a security guard and a guest of the hotel both saw the same type of paranormal thing about 4 years apart. And I'll give them that credit because they saw the same thing years apart without knowing each other. And that was a woman in a dress kind of dancing on the roof of the hotel. The security guard actually called us one night. He was like, oh, you have a guest out on the balcony. You might want to make sure she's not going to fall. And we're like, sir, we don't have balconies. They tore them all down. And then years later, this other woman sitting out by, and she actually did ghost tours up in Savannah. I kind of know her. And she just does a lot of ghost stuff up there. And she's sitting out by the pool and she's like, hey, there's a woman in a dress kind of dancing on the roof, you know, what's going on there? And that's the only actual story that I've heard consistently over the years so far.
So this is after it became the Bellevue Inn that you heard these stories. These are modern.
And this is after it was turned into the Bellevue Inn. Yes.
Wow. So my big question, because it's Historic Preservation Month, when they tore down this original giant wooden structure, you know, there was a big fight, you know, to push back. It was on the historic register, at least the National Historic Register. But you know what? Yeah. They've done a great job with what's left. So is that, you consider it like a preservation victory because that one part was kept intact, or one of the biggest losses in Florida history because it was so significant? It's kind of both the way I look at it, but because I love what they've done with it.
Yeah. It is kind of like Schrodinger's hotel to me because in one breath, it is a little bit of a victory because
yeah.
Most buildings like this would have been torn down in its entirety.
Yeah.
So you would only have pictures and kind of historical accounts to go off of. So in one breath, it's good that you can still walk through the original lobby that kings and presidents and movie stars have been in. On the other hand, the historicity of the Biltmore stemmed just from the legacy that it had, from who built it, what it represents, the property it was at. It was more than just the hotel itself that made the hotel famous. It was the property that it was. It was the golf courses that it established as the first hotel course in the state. And a lot of this. So on the other hand, there's really not anything left of the Bellevue Biltmore that can still be experienced and feel like you're still in this Gilded Age hotel. We would always have former employees visit us, and they were always very happy to see that at least some of the building had been preserved. But it was always shell shock to them because it looked familiar, but at the same time, it wasn't, just because of how much smaller it was, how much it's been renovated. It does have local historic designation through the town of Bel Air now. It is on the town's historic property listing, but it was removed from the National Register of Historic Places when the building itself was moved.
Hmm. Yeah, I was going to say there's no way it's still on the National Register. Can I interject something here about preservation?
Yeah.
That and Rick, I know you belong to the Society of, what's it called?
Commercial Archaeology.
Okay, so you may disagree with me, but as a historian, I see two reasons for preservation. One is the George Washington's letter, right? That's the one, something happened here and we want to preserve that so that people can always come here. It's why, in my mind, it's one of the reasons some of the concentration camps are still there and available to be toured, is something happened here and it was important and we need to make sure history doesn't forget this. That's not the case with the Biltmore, right? Nothing monumental happened. There was no signing of the Declaration of Independence. It was not the site where we tricked the Seminole tribe into signing a treaty, none of that. So then the other reason I see to preserve things is to preserve something that is architecturally significant or that is temporally significant, meaning that it evokes the spirit of the time gone by. And that was the reason to preserve the Biltmore, is that it was this testament to this giant wooden structure. Certainly it had historic ties. I mean, nothing monumental might have happened there, but it was a big deal in history. It spoke to the railroads. It was Henry Plant. He was a baron. It had this thing, and preservation should not have been putting a bunch of condos around it. Preservation, true preservation, would have been maintaining that wooden structure and either operating it as a hotel, and Joey and I can tell you every historic hotel in Florida where you can still go spend the night. So it has been done. And they didn't do that either. Like, just keeping some of the floorboards and saying Henry Plant slept here, in my mind, is not preservation. It's anathema to preservation. They may as well have just taken the wood and sold it to a historic junkyard that deals with something like this.
And they did. And most of the wood For those who might want pieces of the Biltmore, they do have most of it at a historic junkyard in Tampa called Schiller's Architectural Salvage. Has the overwhelming majority of all wooden pieces of the hotel. After all these years, most of their property still is full of Biltmore wood.
Well, that's interesting because last week I gave a talk at Ollie at Eckerd College. It's a lifelong learning program. And I have a talk called Frenemies, and it talks about what I like to call, in casual company, the penis showing game between Henry Plant and Henry Flagler, where they built these hotels as they went down opposite ends of the state, and it was anything you can do, I can do better and bigger. And somebody came up to me after the talk, and they said, I was at a junkyard, and it had like historic stuff, and they said they had stuff from the Biltmore. Is that possible? And I said, absolutely. Absolutely. There are places that salvage things like that. So that's at least good to know. You can go there if you want a piece of it. But
yeah, we should put a link in the show notes because
I'm working on it already.
I want to go there and I want to get a piece of the I call it the Bellevue Biltmore.
It is that's what we're calling it in the show notes, where okay. People can find these links, by the way.
Joey, can you tell us about the go ahead, Joey.
Yeah, I was going to say, the way that I see the current Bellevue Inn, I see it kind of as a monument to the Bellevue Biltmore itself, kind of as just a little bit, a step above a historic marker, but a step below the actual, you know, entity itself. You know, I do see it as a monument to everything that the hotel used to represent and the legacy that was there. So even if it really isn't the same experience or even just the same layout of the structure of the property, it is still a good testament to at least what had always been there. Better than a picture could do, at least. You can still touch the buildings.
Yeah, so I stayed there not long after it opened. You could still smell the paint. And, you know, everywhere. So I love there's a big Christopher Still painting of the property. And, you know, I love it. And there's a spring house, and I was going to try and find the spring house. So I wanted to go down to the water, and, you know, there's all these postcards of the spring house, and I couldn't find a way to get down to the water because of all the condos in between the hotel and the water. And that makes me crazy because, you know, that's the worst thing the whole place has going for me is the location. I think where they chose to leave the building.
It was the highest point of the Florida coastline when Henry Plant first built that hotel. So it was an absolute, that is what Bellevue translates to, the beautiful view across from the highest point of the Florida coastline at Clearwater Harbor and all the pristine, undeveloped barrier islands at the time.
Well, I think it's, and if this was a national park site, if this were a national park site, I think at this point they would refer to it, I believe, as a memorial rather than a monument. I can never remember the difference in the two, but one is the actual physical location. And because they moved it, I wonder if it would be not considered that, but it's not getting national anything designation at this point.
So why'd you guys grimace when I said Christopher Still? Did you not like the painting? I love the painting. You come on, tell us.
I think it's a good painting. It's a it's an amalgamation of a lot of historical themes in there, but it's definitely a representation rather than an accurate, okay, a fully accurate portrayal of the property. But I will say, for all the artwork that I have seen produced for the hotel, it is by far the best. Because it's by far the most professional artwork that I've seen done of the hotel. So I at least appreciate that there's a renowned artist who is interested in preserving how he views the hotel.
So it's not historically accurate, is what you're saying.
It's decently accurate, but there are still it's still fun to kind of pick out the Easter eggs in there that I know were a little more artistic.
Okay. So, but there was a spring, right? On the, you know, right on the coast.
There were multiple springs. So it's a little bit hard to trace some of these numbers down. One of the original plat maps from Bel Air, when they were developing the town in 1896 and kind of building up the area, there were two smaller springs south of the hotel where the golf courses are now. Yeah. And those originally were supposed to be parks for the town site that predated what became the golf courses. I believe one of them might still be there. I've been trying to trace that down. The other spring was much more well-known, and that was known as the Bel Air Mineral Spring. And there are postcards of that. There's a lot of documentation of that, because the hotel very heavily promoted that as this is the source of the hotel's drinking and cooking water. And I don't know if I've ever showed you all this before, Rick, but we have one menu in our archives. It's actually a copy of a menu. I don't have the physical item itself. I don't know where the hotel has this, but we have one single menu from dinner from 1905. And on the bottom in big bold letters, it says all cooking and drinking water taken from local Bel Air mineral spring that is fresh and pure.
Cool.
The only reference I have seen that it was used for cooking and drinking. It's alluded to in brochures and newspaper articles, but never explicitly mentioned. And that actually, the spring house that was built had been removed in the 1920s, but the actual foundation, the brick foundation of that spring house remained all the way until, I believe, 2021. And then when the Bel Air Country Club completely renovated and restored their golf courses about 2 years ago, they actually took where the spring house was. So originally it was when Bel Air, the current town of Bel Air, was founded in the 1920s, they had actually wanted to expand the golf courses to where the spring house was and make the spring house just next to the golf hole and just make that one of the pretty features of it. Well, that never ended up happening, but they had always kept it on the books as, well, the spring now no longer exists because we wanted to make it part of the golf courses. So in the early 2020s, when they renovated the golf courses, they actually removed the foundations of the spring house that were in there. And it's just now the actual golf hole as had been intended back in the 1920s. Christopher Still actually got to visit the location of it, and it's in the video that he made that they show at the hotel. I never got to go document that before it was removed, unfortunately. But it was the foundations of this brick building were still there in the middle of the little swampy area as an offshoot, kind of in the water next to the golf courses.
Thank you for that. That's right. You know, you spoke my language there. I geek out on that kind of stuff, and I appreciate you talking. I do have one more question. PICO, or how do you say, is it Plain Investment Company? Is it PICO or PICO?
I say PICO. I've actually not heard anybody at the Henry Plant Museum or Cantor Brown or anybody else really say it. So I don't know how other folks say it. I've always just said PICO myself.
Yeah, that's what I say. Because there's a PICO building in Sanford that he built.
The PICO building in Sanford is really cool because it was actually the headquarters of the investment company for a while. And it is not really on a list. When you look at buildings left over from Henry Plant, it's not on any of these lists anywhere. And while it wasn't technically a hotel, there actually was boarding house above it. I believe it was about 12 rooms. It wasn't one of these grand hotels that was marketed, but it was still a Plant System hotel. And it's actually not on the list that you see anywhere of Plant System hotels, just because it was always considered kind of just a transit house as you're going between Steamboat and Railroad. But the PICO building, the Bellevue Inn, and the Tampa Bay Hotel as the University of Tampa are the only three buildings left of Henry Plant that are still standing in some forms, really, in Florida, as far as I think any of us have been able to find out.
One last question, Joe. Where would you suggest we tell people to go to learn more about the Bellevue's history? Because I know they have recently stopped funding any history-related endeavors, the private company who owns it. So what website would you suggest people go to? What do we do? What do we tell people to go take a look at?
That is still in the works.
Is there anything that exists that's at least accurate? Okay.
Not yet. That is the other part of my passion project is getting this out there much more. We had done history tours at the hotel for a while, but that was only for the first few years the hotel had opened. At the moment, there's not really any public space where a lot of this is. The Clearwater Historical Society had an exhibit on the hotel that had just ended back in February. The panels for those are in storage, and there actually has been interest to get that elsewhere. So I'm actually working to see what other institutions could have this museum exhibit. The town of Bel Air is reaching their centennial next year. And so we're in the middle of kind of planning this centennial celebration. And my hope is we can get this history exhibit displayed in the town of Bel Air somewhere for the public to see. As of this exact moment, there is not yet a physical or virtual presence for the hotel's history. But I can definitely update y'all on that once we get all that set up. I want to have a nice big old website thesis of all of this information, because it does need to be out and preserved.
And I have to say, when I stayed there, I think the history tour was one of my favorite things of this day, honestly.
And you must have been there right before I had started, because
yeah, it was somebody else.
Yeah, there was a historian there for about 5 weeks prior to when I had started. So yeah, mine used to be award winning back in the day.
Well, bring it back. Bring back Joey. Bring back Joey. Bring back Joey.
All right. All right. I feel like the capitalist pigs who now have ownership are not listening to my podcast. And if they are, I apologize. Clearly, you're not just a capitalist pig. You are enlightened and cultured.
There goes that sponsorship.
You know, and we're not getting Publix either. So
burning bridges left and right.
That's, I miss Black Coral Rum. They were good sponsors and good rum. They were good Drink sponsors. Drink the rum.
Wear the shirt.
Wear the shirt with pride. Hey, Joey, thank you for coming on the podcast again. I look forward to seeing your exhibit. We're going to send out the show notes. I will include a link that people can stay there. We should point that out, that you can stay at what is now called the Bellevue Inn, but be advised, you're not going to be staying. There are no rooms in the historic part of the hotel.
Isn't that section historic? The above the lobby?
The rooms are reconfigured. So part of the restoration, and partly why the historic designation was removed from the national level, is that even though the rooms themselves are restored and refurbished, they are not the original floor plan layouts of the hotel rooms. The interior walls were completely reconfigured and realigned for the restoration. Okay. And because this was the core lobby of the oldest part of the building, so from 1897, the original hotel rooms were the smallest rooms in the entire complex. And so just in modernizing the hotel as had been wanted to do, it was just decided to make the rooms normal sized rather than Victorian sized. So they're normal sized rooms, but that is, so when Kathy's saying that, be advised, it's not a historic room. It's not historic in that the wood floorboards will creak and you can still see the massive closet where the big travel trunks would be. You now just have a standard hotel room in the old building type thing.
That makes sense.
And that decision was made because, I mean, for those who did get to stay at the old Bellevue Biltmore, especially in the later 1990s and early 2000s, the building needed a massive overhaul. As beautiful as it was, I mean, everything really needed, every system in the building needed to be completely replaced and overhauled. So part of the decision to not keep the rooms the original size was just to bring it up to modern standards and make it nicer as well.
Great. Well, that said, the only thing I have to add is when I was in high school, we had one of our winter formal dances there.
Everybody somewhere has a connection to it.
Yeah.
It was a very special place.
We want photos.
Oof.
Yeah. I want photos too for historical purposes.
Well, it would have just been me and my Neanderthal boyfriend at the time. No disrespect to Neanderthals, but his gifts were not academic. And I didn't really show the background of the hotel. So I don't care.
I want to see your hair.
I will see what my mother has, and then I will show my shame. Hey, I want to give a shout out, not only thanking Joey, I want to thank everybody who came up to me at the Floridania Festival, and a couple of weeks ago at Tiki Agogo. It's great to know that our listeners are out there experiencing Florida and seeing all the reasons it's so spectacular. So that said, Rick, do you have anything to add? I love your t-shirt.
Thank you. Florida Spectacular. It's nice to know that we're just not talking to a vacuum and that there are people out there listening to us. It is affirming. And, you know, I would love to, we love comments and, you know, give them the email address to reach us if you, I can't remember.
Yes. Kathy@floridaspectacular.com. Send us comments. Sometimes we send you t-shirts. We if you join us on Florida Keys Spectacular for $5 a month, we do have a lovely welcome gift for you if you reach out. So feel free to support the podcast that way and then send me your email or your address and we will get you some stuff in the mail. You know, I was thinking before we go real quick, there's a podcast I listen to. It's a sci-fi podcast. I'm not sure how much of a Venn diagram there are between Florida history people and time traveling diner, but there's this podcast I listen to called Midnight Burger. And I love it so much. It's so clever and funny and well-written that I joined on a supporting level. And when they learn from their mistakes, and I don't know if they think it's a mistake, when they started the podcast, they said, hey, join us at this level and above, and we'll give you a shout out at the end of every episode, and you can use whatever name you want. And now it's like a 15-minute list of names. And it's funny. People choose funny names. But I thought maybe we should offer it a shout out to people who support Florida Keys Spectacular. But then I thought, no, that could really get away with it. We thank them once. That's the names are funny to listen to. But no, we're not going to do that. All right. Well, that'll do it. Rick, I will see you next week. Same bat time, same bat channel. And Joey, I will see you in the ether of history. Have a great week, y'all.
Thank y'all for having me.